Hello, this podcast is talking about Seminar 3 and the questions therein. Question 1. How is financial regulation in the UK structured? Which markets are regulated and how? Something of a sort of deliberate trick question, maybe, if you're me, because I'm never entirely sure what it is we are regulating. The talk is always, and if we look at the Regulated Activities Order, and we look at the Financial Services and Markets Act, that we are regulating particular types of financial product, and that would seem at first blush to be what we're doing. And therefore, we would tend to say, well, we are regulating the business of selling derivatives, the business of selling securities, and so on and so forth. So, the answer to the first question, at face level, is that the FSA handbook is primarily concerned with investments and not with deposit-taking banking. Although we'll talk about deposit-taking banking regulation much later in the course and see the FSA has increasingly more and more to do with the ordinary activities of banks, particularly since 2005 it took over the regulation of mortgage business. So primarily it's about investments and investment markets, not high street deposit taking and those kind of banking activities. All the things that are discussed in chapter 29 and onwards in the book. And yet, section 19 is really concerned with, yes, the regulation of activities. We also get this in section 22, what are the regulated activities? Things that are conducted by way of business and which are defined in schedule 2 according to those lists of activity. But we're still regulating, quote, authorised persons and, quote, firms. So I think what's really going on, what the regulation is really doing, looked at closely, is that we are identifying a way of regulating particular people. And I think we're really regulating the seller side. What do I mean by that? We're regulating people who are selling financial services, in the business of marketing and selling financial services. So we really are focusing on the big financial institutions. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why we end up with lots of lacunae, areas that aren't regulated very closely at all, and certain people who aren't regulated. This is why we have this kind of twilight world of hedge funds and these entities that tend to buy these investments rather than sell them, I would suggest. So that's how you can be dealing in these things effectively in London. But if you're not on the seller side, you seem to escape the regulatory net. That's how I read how these regulations work in practice. So the quick answer, what do we regulate? We regulate all the things that are listed in Schedule 2. But I think we really are focused on the financial institutions. And that's why a file I'm putting up on the website, the European Union, is talking about regulating hedge funds through a new directive. So there are areas of financial activity that really aren't regulated as closely as they could be. Private equity business is another, which is discussed in chapter 42 in the book. So if you're interested in those kind of areas, I think that's a lot of what's going on with regulation in that way. So that's paragraph 9, 10 and onwards. Very important then in terms of, if you like, the jurisprudence of financial regulation, and this is paragraph 9, 17 and onwards, is the Principles for Businesses Rulebook, or PRIN, which sets out those 11 core principles for businesses. We're focusing this particular topic on conduct of business, and I want to steer your attention specifically to conduct of business. Now, remember the requirements that firms must act with integrity. Remember the requirements that the firm under Principle 6 must look to the customer's interests. A firm must pay due regard to the interests of its customers and treat them fairly. And I would suggest that in the context of conduct of business, there are two very important principles there about acting with integrity and treating your customers fairly, which help us to interpret how conduct of business regulation might operate in the future. Which brings us on to question 2, what were the new developments in relation to client care that were introduced by MiFID? MiFID was responsible for introducing new principles to do with best execution for recasting, certainly, the requirement that we act in the best interests of clients, and for talking about the way in which communications must be fair, clear, and not misleading. So I think that building out from PRIN, that Principles for Businesses source book, and its central principles, we can come specifically to the COBS rule book, the Conduct of Business source book, which implements the detail of MiFID, and we can see requirements like the best execution requirement, firms must take all reasonable steps to obtain the best possible results for their clients, the best interests of the client requirement, must act honestly, fairly and professionally in accordance with the best interests of the client, and that all information directed at the client shall be fair, clear and not misleading. And what we can see there is, again, further interpretive principles. Because what we have to do when we start looking at problem questions is to take those general principles and ask, if those are the general requirements, how have we treated this individual here? What are the sorts of things which we should have done and not done? So we take those very general principles and we just discuss the facts and raise what the issues are in very general terms. This is a different kind of lawyering, perhaps, from the kind of lawyering you're used to from trusts law or contract law, in that we just don't have case law really to help us. So what you have to do instead is kind of argue from first principles. And what we'll be doing in later topics is to knit this together with proper contract law and ask, well, what does regulation do? What does proper contract law do? But we just don't have cases on this stuff, so you have to argue in general terms. And the way you can bend that to your advantage, I would suggest, two things. Number one, you can broaden out into general discussions of how do we think we should regulate financial institutions? Do we want to hinder innovation? Do we want to hinder markets or risk doing so by having really quite strict regulation which requires financial institutions to jump through every hoop in relation to dealings with customers? Or do we want to go the other way and have lighter touch regulation and run the risk that while we may facilitate innovation, we are going to repeat the global financial crisis of 2007 through 2009 by giving banks too much latitude? So you can get into those kind of debates in helping you to apply the general principles. So I suggest setting out the general principles, looking at the facts of a problem, or we're going to look at the facts of question five, Gerald, in a second, and then just discuss in general terms how you think that functions, what you think the appropriate regulatory response ought to be. And then after doing that, I would suggest you could start talking in general terms about how you think regulation ought to function. Now, that's why we spent a lot of time in the early part of the course setting up some of these general themes. And we're going to pursue those themes through the course a lot more. So your ideas on this may yet develop, but that's one way of going about it. Another way of going about it is to look at areas where there might be some useful case law for you to rely on. And that, in part, is going to be the question, which I think is very interesting personally, of whether or not these conduct of business sourcebook principles are actually creating fiduciary duties. You know, will the general law interpret this as being a set of fiduciary obligations? And in the lectures, doing all of that, we looked at some of the case law, particularly Lord Justice Asquith in Reading and the Attorney General. Whenever the plaintiff entrusts to the defendant a job to be performed, for instance, the negotiation of a contract on his behalf or for his benefit, and relies on the defendant to procure for the plaintiff the best terms available, that will be a fiduciary obligation. Well, that's almost word for word, the best interests of the client's requirement in COBS and in MiFID. So, talked about this a lot, separate podcast and all of that, but I think that's one of the issues you might bring up in dealing with a client. You know, does this cross the line into being fiduciary? And what is the effect of that? We can't take profits from that client that are unauthorised on a Boardman and Phipps model, and all those other sorts of things we've studied in fiduciary law that we will come back to again later in the course when we do breach of trust. But I think it's just interesting to flag that up as an idea. Banks won't want this. They won't want to face fiduciary obligations. Look, to keep these podcasts not too big a file and not to make them over long, I'm going to chop this one in half. I'm going to pause there. In a separate podcast, I'll then come on to talk about conduct of business regulation and what we do with question five.